First Love. 1. In the early years of this century, a travel agency on Nevsky Avenue displayed a 3-foot-long model of an oak-brown international sleeping car. In delicate verisimilitude, it completely outranked the painted tin of my clockwork trains. Unfortunately, it was not for sale. One could make out the blue upholstery inside, the embossed leather lining of the compartment walls, their polished panels, inset mirrors, tulip-shaped reading lamps, and other maddening details. Spacious windows alternated with narrower ones, single or geminate, and some of these were of frosted glass. In a few of the compartments, the beds had been made. The then great and glamorous Nord Express, it was never the same after World War I, consisting solely of such international cars and running but twice a week, connected St. Petersburg with Paris. I would have said directly with Paris, had passengers not been obliged to change from one train to a superficially similar one at the Russo-German frontier, Vers Bolovo et Konin, where the ample and lazy Russian 60.5-inch gauge was replaced by the 56.5-inch standard of Europe, and coal succeeded birch logs. In the far end of my mind I can unravel, I think, at least 5 such journeys to Paris, with the Riviera or Biarritz as their ultimate destination. In 1909, the year I now single out, my 2 small sisters had been left at home with nurses and aunts. Wearing gloves and a traveling cap, my father sat reading a book in the compartment he shared with our tutor. My brother and I were separated from them by a washroom. My mother and her maid occupied a compartment adjacent to ours. The odd one of our party, my father's valet, Osip, whom, a decade later, the pedantic Bolsheviks were to shoot because he appropriated our bicycles instead of turning them over to the nation, had a stranger for companion. In April of that year, Perry had reached the North Pole. In May, Chelyapin had sung in Paris. In June, bothered by rumors of new and better Zeppelins, the United States War Department had told reporters of plans for an aerial navy. In July, Blériot had flown from Calais to Dover with a little additional loop when he lost his bearings. It was late August now. The firs and marshes of northwestern Russia sped by, and on the following day gave way to German pine barrens and heather. At a collapsible table, my mother and I played a card game called Durachki. Although it was still broad daylight, our cards, a glass, and on a different plane the locks of a suitcase, were reflected in the window. Through forest and field, and in sudden ravines and among scuttling cottages, those discarnate gamblers kept steadily playing on for steadily sparkling stakes. Ne budetli ti ved ustal? Haven't you had enough? Aren't you tired? My mother would ask, and then would be lost in thought as she slowly shuffled the cards. The door of the compartment was open, and I could see the corridor window, where the wires, 6 thin black wires, were doing their best to slant up, to ascend skyward, despite the lightning blows dealt them by one telegraph pole after another. But just as all 6, in a triumphant swoop of pathetic elation, were about to reach the top of the window, a particularly vicious blow would bring them down as low as they had ever been, and they would have to start all over again. When, on such journeys as these, the train changed its pace to a dignified amble, and all but grazed house fronts and shop signs as we passed through some big German town, I used to feel a twofold excitement, which terminal stations could not provide. I saw a city with its toy-like trams, linden trees, and brick walls enter the compartment, hobnob with the mirrors, and fill to the brim the windows on the corridor side. This informal contact between train and city was one part of the thrill. The other was putting myself in the place of some passerby, who, I imagined, was moved as I would be moved myself to see the long, romantic auburn cars with their intervestibular connecting curtains, as black as bat wings, and their metal lettering copper bright in the low sun, unhurriedly negotiate an iron bridge across an everyday thoroughfare, and then turn, with all windows suddenly ablaze, around a last block of houses. There were drawbacks to those optical amalgamations. The wide-windowed dining car, a vista of chased bottles of mineral water, miter-folded napkins and dummy chocolate bars, whose wrappers, cahier, Kohler, and so forth, enclosed nothing but wood, would be perceived at first as a cool haven beyond a consecution of reeling blue corridors, but as the meal progressed toward its fatal last course, one would keep catching the car in the act of being recklessly sheathed, lurching, waiters and all, in the landscape, while the landscape itself went through a complex system of motion. The daytime moon stubbornly keeping abreast of one's plate, the distant meadows opening fan-wise, the near trees sweeping up on invisible swings toward the track, a parallel rail line all at once committing suicide by anastomosis, a bank of nictitating grass rising, 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 until the little witness of mixed velocities was made to disgorge his portion of omelette aux confitures de fraises. It was at night, however, that the Compagnie Internationale des Wagons-Lits et des Grands Express Européens lived up to the magic of its name. From my bed under my brother's bunk, was he asleep? Was he there at all? In the semi-darkness of our compartment, I watched things and parts of things and shadows and sections of shadows cautiously moving about and getting nowhere. The woodwork gently creaked and crackled. Near the door that led to the toilet, a dim garment on a peg and, higher up, the tassel of the blue bivalved nightlight swung rhythmically. It was hard to correlate those halting approaches, that hooded stealth, with the headlong rush of the outside night, which I knew was rushing by. Spark Street. Illegible. I would put myself to sleep by the simple act of identifying myself with the engine driver. A sense of drowsy well-being invaded my veins as soon as I had everything nicely arranged. The carefree passengers in their rooms enjoying the ride I was giving them, smoking, exchanging knowing smiles, nodding, dozing, the waiters and cooks and train guards, whom I had to place somewhere, carousing in the diner, and myself, goggled and begrimed, peering out of the engine cab at the tapering track, at the ruby or emerald point in the black distance. And then, in my sleep, I would see something totally different. A glass marble rolling under a grand piano, or a toy engine lying on its side with its wheels still working gamely. A change in the speed of the train sometimes interrupted the current of my sleep. Slow lights were stalking by. Each, in passing, investigated the same chink, and then a luminous compass measured the shadows. Presently, the train stopped with a long-drawn Westinghousean sigh. Something, my brother's spectacles, as it proved next day, fell from above. It was marvelously exciting to move to the foot of one's bed with part of the bedclothes following, in order to undo cautiously the catch of the window shade, which could be made to slide only halfway up, impeded as it was by the edge of the upper berth. Like moons around Jupiter, pale moths revolved about a lone lamp, a dismembered newspaper stirred on a bench. Somewhere on the train one could hear muffled voices, somebody's comfortable cough. There was nothing particularly interesting in the portion of station platform before me, and still I could not tear myself away from it until it departed of its own accord. Next morning, wet fields with misshapen willows along the radius of a ditch or a row of poplars afar, traversed by a horizontal band of milky white mist, told one that the train was spinning through Belgium. It reached Paris at 4 p.m., and even if the stay was only an overnight one, I had always time to purchase something, say a little brass Tour Eiffel, rather roughly coated with silver paint, before we boarded at noon on the following day the Sud Express, which, on its way to Madrid, dropped us around 10 p.m. at the La Négresse station of Biarritz, a few miles from the Spanish frontier. 2. Biarritz still retained its quiddity in those days. Dusty blackberry bushes and weedy terrain au vendre bordered the road that led to our villa. The Carlton was still being built. Some 36 years had to elapse before Brigadier General Samuel McCroskey would occupy the royal suite of the Hotel du Palais, which stands on the site of a former palace, where, in the '60s, that incredibly agile medium, Daniel Home, is said to have been caught stroking with his bare foot, in imitation of a ghost hand, the kind, trustful face of Empress Eugenie. On the promenade near the casino, an elderly flower girl with carbon eyebrows and a painted smile nimbly slipped the plump torus of a carnation into the buttonhole of an intercepted stroller, whose left jowl accentuated its royal fold as he glanced down sideways at the coy insertion of the flower. Along the back line of the plage, various seaside chairs and stools supported the parents of straw-hatted children who were playing in front on the sand. I could be seen on my knees trying to set a found comb aflame by means of a magnifying glass. Men sported white trousers that, to the eye of today, would look as if they had comically shrunk in the washing. Ladies wore, that particular season, light coats with silk-faced lapels, hats with big crowns and wide brims, dense embroidered white veils, frill-fronted blouses, frills at their waists, frills on their parasols. The breeze salted one's lips. At a tremendous pace, a stray golden-orange butterfly came dashing across the palpitating plage. Additional movement and sound were provided by vendors hawking cacahuete, sugared violets, pistachio ice cream of a heavenly green, cashew pellets, and huge convex pieces of dry, gritty, wafer-like stuff that came from a red barrel. With a distinctness that no later superpositions have dimmed, I see that waffle man stomp along through deep, mealy sand with the heavy cask on his bent back. When called, he would sling it off his shoulder by a twist of its strap, bang it down on the sand in a Tower of Pisa position, wipe his face with his sleeve, and proceed to manipulate a kind of arrow and dial arrangement with numbers on the lid of the cask. The arrow rasped and whirred around. Luck was supposed to fix the size of a sou's worth of wafer. The bigger the piece, the more I was sorry for him. The process of bathing took place on another part of the beach. Professional bathers, burly Basques in black bathing suits, were there to help ladies and children enjoy the terrors of the surf. Such a bagneur would place you with your back to the incoming wave and hold you by the hand as the rising, rotating mass of foamy green water violently descended upon you from behind, knocking you off your feet with one mighty wallop. After a dozen of these tumbles, the bagneur, glistening like a seal, would lead his panting, shivering, moistly snuffling charge landward to the flat foreshore, where an unforgettable old woman with gray hairs on her chin promptly chose a bathing robe from several hanging on a clothesline. In the security of a little cabin, one would be helped by yet another attendant to peel off one's soggy, sand-heavy bathing suit. It would plop onto the boards, and, still shivering, one would step out of it and trample on its bluish, diffuse stripes. The cabin smelled of pine. The attendant, a hunchback with beaming wrinkles, brought a basin of steaming hot water in which one immersed one's feet. From him I learned, and have preserved ever since in a glass cell of my memory, that butterfly, in the Basque language, is misericoletia, or at least it sounded so. Among the seven words I have found in dictionaries, the closest approach is micheletia. 3. On the browner and wetter part of the plage, that part which at low tide yielded the best mud for castles, I found myself digging one day, side by side with a little French girl called Colette. She would be 10 in November. I had been 10 in April. Attention was drawn to a jagged bit of violet mussel shell upon which she had stepped with the bare sole of her narrow, long-toed foot. No, I was not English. Her greenish eyes seemed flecked with the overflow of the freckles that covered her sharp-featured face. She wore what might now be termed a play suit, consisting of a blue jersey with rolled-up sleeves and blue knitted shorts. I had taken her at first for a boy, and then had been puzzled by the bracelet on her thin wrist and the corkscrew brown curls dangling from under her sailor cap. She spoke in bird-like bursts of rapid twitter, mixing governess English and Parisian French. 2 years before, on the same plage, I had been much attached to the lovely, suntanned little daughter of a Serbian physician, but when I met Colette, I knew at once that this was the real thing. Colette seemed to me so much stranger than all my other chance playmates at Biarritz. I somehow acquired the feeling that she was less happy than I, less loved. A bruise on her delicate downy forearm gave rise to awful conjectures. "He pinches as bad as my mummy," she said, speaking of a crab. I evolved various schemes to save her from her parents, who were des bourgeois de Paris, as I heard somebody tell my mother with a slight shrug. I interpreted the disdain in my own fashion, as I knew that those people had come all the way from Paris in their blue and yellow limousine, a fashionable adventure in those days, but had drably sent Colette with her dog and governess by an ordinary coach train. The dog was a female fox terrier with bells on her collar and a most waggly behind. From sheer exuberance, she would lap up salt water out of Colette's toy pail. I remember the sail, the sunset, and the lighthouse pictured on that pail, but I cannot recall the dog's name, and this bothers me. During the 2 months of our stay at Biarritz, my passion for Colette all but surpassed my passion for butterflies. Since my parents were not keen to meet hers, I saw her only on the beach, but I thought of her constantly. If I noticed she had been crying, I felt a surge of helpless anguish that brought tears to my own eyes. I could not destroy the mosquitoes that had left their bites on her frail neck, but I could and did have a successful fistfight with a red-haired boy who had been rude to her. She used to give me warm handfuls of hard candy. One day, as we were bending together over a starfish and Colette's ringlets were tickling my ear, she suddenly turned toward me and kissed me on the cheek. So great was my emotion that all I could think of saying was, "You little monkey." I had a gold coin that I assumed would pay for our elopement. Where did I want to take her? Spain? America? The mountains above Po? Là-bas, là-bas, dans la montagne, as I had heard Carmen sing at the opera. One strange night I lay awake, listening to the recurrent thud of the ocean and planning our flight. The ocean seemed to rise and grope in the darkness and then heavily fall on its face. Of our actual getaway I have little to report. My memory retains a glimpse of her obediently putting on rope-soled canvas shoes on the lee side of a flapping tent while I stuffed a folding butterfly net into a brown paper bag. The next glimpse is of our evading pursuit by entering a pitch-dark cinema near the casino, which of course was absolutely out of bounds. There we sat, holding hands across the dog, which now and then gently jingled in Colette's lap, and were shown a jerky, drizzly, but highly exciting bullfight at Saint-Sébastien. My final glimpse is of myself being led along the promenade by my tutor. His long legs move with a kind of ominous briskness, and I can see the muscles of his grimly set jaw working under the tight skin. My bespectacled brother, age 9, whom he happens to hold with his other hand, keeps trotting out forward to peer at me with awed curiosity, like a little owl. Among the trivial souvenirs acquired at Biarritz before leaving, my favorite was not the small bowl of black stone, and not the sonorous seashell, but something which now seems almost symbolic, a meerschaum penholder with a tiny peephole of crystal in its ornamental part. One held it quite close to one's eye, screwing up the other, and when one had got rid of the shimmer of one's own lashes, a miraculous photographic view of the bay and of the line of cliffs ending in a lighthouse could be seen inside. And now a delightful thing happens. The process of recreating that penholder and the microcosm in its islet stimulates my memory to a last effort. I try again to recall the name of Colette's dog, and sure enough, along those remote beaches, over the glossy evening sands of the past, where each footprint slowly fills up with sunset water, here it comes, echoing and vibrating, Floss, Floss, Floss. Colette was back in Paris by the time we stopped there for a day before continuing our homeward journey, and there, in a fawn park under a cold blue sky, I saw her, by arrangement between our mentors, I believe, for the last time. She carried a hoop and a short stick to drive it with, and everything about her was extremely proper and stylish in an autumnal Parisian tenue de ville pour filette way. She took from her governess and slipped into my brother's hand a farewell present, a box of sugar-coated almonds, meant, I knew, solely for me, and instantly she was off, tap-tapping her glinting hoop through light and shade, around and around the fountain choked with dead leaves near which I stood. The leaves mingle in my memory with the leather of her shoes and gloves, and there was, I remember, some detail in her attire, perhaps a ribbon on her Scottish cap or the pattern of her stockings, that reminded me then of the rainbow spiral in a glass marble. I still seemed to be holding that wisp of iridescence, not knowing exactly where to fit it, while she runs with her hoop ever faster around me and finally dissolves among the slender shadows cast on the graveled path by the interlaced arches of its low-looped fence.